Monasticism, the 11th talk in a series titled History of Christian Thought, was presented by David Crabtree on December 7, 1987, for McKenzie Study Center's School of Exegesis. McKenzie Study Center is now an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side. The following recording was made in a classroom setting, and many of the students' questions were inaudible. It is hoped that Dr. Crabtree's answers will be sufficient to understand the context.
We will talk about monasticism today. This is a very strange topic for me, because I think that had I been born in another time, I would have become a monk. There are things about it that are very attractive to me, but there are other things that are just bizarre. So what I would like to do is look at how monasticism came about, what the basic ideas were behind the formation of monasticism, and look a little bit at how it has developed. And then the last part, I just want to talk about what monasticism tries to accomplish and analyze that. Monasticism clearly was an outgrowth of asceticism. Asceticism was strong in the early church, and monasticism was just a further development, another way of living an ascetic lifestyle. It was just asceticism taken to a step further. It became popular in early in the second century, and by the year 250 in Egypt, we have what is called the development of the Desert Fathers, or the flight to the desert. Apparently, Egypt is where monasticism began. And at first, there were people who devoted themselves to a life of asceticism, but they would stay in the cities, they would stay in the communities, and they would just fast and commit themselves to chastity and pray so often a day and stuff like that. But the next step was for them to move out of the cities, and by 250 we have what's called the flight to the desert, or the Desert Fathers. They would leave the city, they'd go find some cave or something, and they would live there, separate from everybody else.
Why is it always a cave?
Well, I don't know. Sometimes it was in ruins, but caves were the easiest. I guess there are lots of them in Egypt. I don't know. There arose a debate at this time when there was this movement to the deserts. People in the Christian community were saying, these people are, these monks, these people who are leaving, they are fleeing from the battle. They're just getting out where they can get away from all the troubles that we face in the city. Persecution was still a threat, theological disputes, that sort of thing. They were saying that this is just escapism. The monks who left, they said, no, we are the frontline troops. We are going out to the battle. So we have taken the harder of the two options. And they often in their literature depicted themselves as soldiers, God's soldiers. And oftentimes their fights were with demonic forces. Well, as time went on, that perspective was the one that won out. At the popular level, people began to see them as indeed soldiers for Christianity. who were fighting on the front lines. The idea was that they were going out away from the comforts of society. They were going to live an ascetic lifestyle and thereby encourage the greatest amount of temptation from demonic forces. So as they pictured it, they were taking the brunt of the satanic attack on Christendom. The first name we have, well, there's Paul of Thebes is the first monk of notoriety. The second person of notoriety is Pachomius, I guess. We don't know very much about him, except that he was a truth seeker. He was one who traveled all over looking for wisdom, in search of wisdom. And in search of wisdom, he even traveled to India for a period of time and studied there. Then he came back to Egypt. Well, he ended up in Egypt, in Alexandria, became a Christian, and then became a monk. And it is he who first organized the monks into a loose organization. And typically, all it consisted of was the monks who were living in their caves would gather once a day for a period of time when they would pray together and that sort of thing. And then they'd go back to their caves. And that style of monasticism is called the Cenobites. Monks who practiced that form of monasticism are called Cenobites. There was another style of monasticism that developed at about the same time. No, this is a style of monasticism. The other form, or the other kind of monasticism, are the Anchorites. From anachoreo, which means to depart or withdraw, they were the ones who went out all by themselves, alone, and no contact with anybody else. So these are the two early forms of monasticism.
Did they go out in groups or just isolated?
The Anchorites were solitary.
Okay.
Another word that is used is the hermetic, coming from desert, hermas. They would go out in a place in the desert and they wouldn't see anybody maybe their whole life, sometimes on two or three occasions in their life they'd see somebody. In the early days in Egypt, in the beginning of monasticism, it is for the most part an anti-intellectual movement that, as they saw it, it was either unnecessary or it was counterproductive to do any studying in the way that they spent their time. They would do what they had to do to keep themselves alive, and the rest of the time they would spend praying and meditating, not studying, in the very early times. The champion of, and he was an Anchorite, is St. Anthony. And he makes fun of any kind of learning, considers that it useless if not counter. Well, what we have is the life of St. Anthony written by St. Athanasius, who, as you might recall, was the proponent of the Orthodox view in the Trinitarian controversy. He was the one that came out against the Arians. What he wrote, what is called the life of St. Anthony, and that was translated during the time of Jerome and disseminated in the western half of the Roman Empire. And it is that work, more than anything else, that got monasticism started in the western half of the empire. Just a sec. And in that, you have a description of what St. Anthony did, and you also have a fairly lengthy sermon by St. Anthony. And in what St. Anthony did, you have a couple of times when philosophers go out to talk to him, or theologians go out to talk to him. And he makes fools of them. And in doing so, demonstrates how insignificant their time spent learning has been, how useless that's all been. And then in his sermon, he downplays the role of learning. I don't know, he may have had some learning. He was from a wealthy family, and after he was converted, he was in a church, and he heard the story of the wealthy young man, and Jesus told him to sell everything and go out, and so he did that. Except he saved back a portion for his sister. His parents had died. Later on, he read, "Don't Worry About Tomorrow, for each day has enough cares of its own," or something like that. And so he went out and gave away the rest of his wealth and put his sister in a convent. And then he went out in the desert and became an anchorite monk. On a couple of occasions, he came into Alexandria, and that's when he had contact with St. Athanasius. Well, he... to come into civilization two times in a lifetime is not having continual contact. There were occasions where people came out and talked to him, but I don't know how long the span of time was, but something like once every, I would guess, it makes it sound like it's once every 2 or 3 years he has a visitor. So it's not, I mean, he's not completely cut off from all human contact, but it's substantially removed, and that's what the anchorites did. That's typical. In his biography, that's a real common theme, is monsters and beasts and all kinds of things. Monks, demons in the form of monks come and tempt him. And, that's a real common theme that happens over and over in his biography. Now, I didn't know that he was the saint of healing, but that would make sense because his remains, he instructed his followers to bury him and not tell anyone where he was buried. But his body was miraculously found in the 5th or 6th century. And then the bones were taken to a church in the south. Well, it went to several places, but they ended up in the south of France. And then during one of the plagues, a number of healings were associated with the bones of St. Anthony. So that must be where that would come from. If there's time at the end, I'll read a little bit from St. Anthony's sermon. It's kind of interesting. It portrays his theology. The Cenobite monks turned out to be a significant political force during the times of theological controversy, especially during the Trinitarian controversy and the Christological controversy. Any kind of deviation from proper doctrine was extremely significant. And as they heard about the controversies and the debates going on within the cities, they would decide what side they were on, and they would go into the city whenever necessary and make their presence felt. And in their minds, nothing was out of bounds. They were willing to go to any length to defend orthodoxy. And so we have instances where mobs of monks would attack a church and kill people and stuff like that to try to get their side to win out in the controversy. That's front lines. Well, they saw themselves as soldiers, and they're just carrying this. Primarily, these were the Cenobites. The Anchorites were not organized. Now, it is, St. Anthony, for instance, was an Anchorite. He came in to Alexandria and made his position known in the Trinitarian controversy. And apparently, went over a lot of followers. The anchorites, or the eremitic monks, as things evolved, they did more and more bizarre things. One of the later anchorites, his name was Simeon the Stylite. You may have heard of this fellow. He built this column about 15 feet high with a platform on the top that was 3 feet in diameter with a railing. And he went up there and stayed there for I don't remember how many years.
How tall was it?
About 15 feet high was the first one. And it was, the platform was so small and lie down to sleep. So he would sleep, oftentimes bent over. And he got so limber that he could be up on the platform with his head touching the ground. His feet and his head touching.
Oh, you mean the ground of the platform?
The platform. Yes. It's 15 feet high and about 3 feet in diameter on the top.
So it would be standing on it.
He would sleep with his feet touching, those feet touching the ground, knees not bent,
and head
waist bent, head touching the ground.
Sleep standing.
That's incredible.
But then he replaced that with a taller one and taller. He finally got up to about 30 feet high. And he spent a total of, I don't remember what it is, it's like 40 years. Every night his disciples would carry food up to him. But that became kind of a fad. There were more and more people who lived on top of pillars. Why? Because all of this is an attempt to demonstrate devotion to God and sincerity of faith. And the idea is that if one denies himself, admits himself to difficulties, hardships, then he will become the object of temptation. If he withstands that temptation, then he is dealing Satan a terrible blow. We'll talk a little bit more about where it came from later. That's basically that. What?
What Satan thought about there?
I'll bet he was just gnashing his teeth.
Did he get a lot of visitors?
Yes.
All around?
Yes. In fact, emperors visited him. Well, there was a lot of attention. He got a lot of attention. 3 emperors paid visits to him. No, they stayed down. I don't think you'd want to be up on the platform. Other anchorites went out and they would live. For instance, some of them lived, they would only eat grass. And they would graze in the evenings. There's another guy who, he would only drink dew that fell on the grass, and he would collect that every morning. That's the only thing he would drink. And there's another guy who walked around on all fours, and he was shot by someone by mistake. There's another guy who a gnat bit him and he killed it, and so he spent the rest of his life stripped naked near a swamp, allowing himself to be eaten alive by mosquitoes and gnats and all that sort of thing. So there are a lot of, it's just, it turns into a zoo-like atmosphere where everybody's trying to get into the Guinness Book of World Records, try to outdo the other person. It's just things that make no sense. Another guy, I think I told you this one. Yeah, he clenched his fists and allowed his fingernails to go through. So stuff like that. All of this, obviously, dealing mortal blows to Satan. These anchorites were so bizarre that at first people were afraid of them. They thought this was a very dangerous development, and that these people were lunatics. But as time went on, they became more and more revered, and there are more and more of them.
Which probably really
accelerates the movement. Yeah. Yeah. Well, yes, they see it all as fitting into the New Testament teaching. But remember, at this time, their understanding of the New Testament was that basically Jesus was the new lawgiver. And Jerome took it further. Origen had taken it further, and his understanding of the Christian life was that there are two levels of Christian conduct. There is the standard morality that you shouldn't murder, you shouldn't commit adultery, you shouldn't worship idols, all that sort of thing. But that is expected of any Christian. But then there is the super Christian. There's one who goes above and beyond the call of duty, and that includes fasting and chastity and a whole list of things. Well, these people are shooting for that super Christian award. It's not enough for them to just obey the new law that Christ brought. They are going to go out and outdo everyone else. Their understanding was that the seed of sin in man is his passions, his desires. So anything that you do that is denying yourself your desires is above and beyond the call of duty. If you clenched your fist like this, your desire is to open it. So if you don't open it, you're going above and beyond the call of duty. You're resisting sin. Well, then that is different, because that is not the desire of the flesh. Well, let me talk about that. I was going to talk about that later, but let's talk about it now. It is very interesting. First of all, it is very interesting that monasticism got started in the eastern half of the empire, and it wasn't until after the time of Jerome that it got started in the western half of the empire. Jerome is the one who was largely responsible for getting monasticism going in the western half of the empire. In the eastern half of the empire, there is a significant amount of contact between the peoples of the eastern half of the empire and India, and points east. So, for instance, Pachomius traveled to India, and he was not the only Christian who traveled to India. He was not the only Greek who traveled to India. And at that time, Hindu monasticism was well developed. And for the most part, they were of the Anchoritic type, the Hindus. The Buddhist monasticism at that time was underway as well, but it was much more organized. They had monasteries, they had practices that everyone in the monastery was supposed to follow, and we'll see that is much closer to what develops in the western half of the empire. But it seems pretty clear to me that, first of all, the ideas that had crept into Christianity allowed this to develop. The idea that the created world is bad, and the important part of that is the body is a created thing. The body is bad. The body is the seed of sin. It's flesh that's the seed of sin. And part of that body is desires. And so if one can just gain self-control over those desires, then one can be perfect. Let me read you some of the passages from St. Anthony. With such thoughts, then, let a man persuade himself not to regard this matter lightly, especially if he considers that he is himself a servant of the Lord and owes service to his master. Hence, as a servant would not dare to say, I am not going to work today because I worked yesterday, and he would not refuse to do any work on the following days because he was counting the past, but would daily, as it is written in the Gospel, show the same readiness to please his master and avoid danger. So we too should persevere daily in the practice of asceticism, knowing that the Lord will not pardon us for the sake of the past if we are careless for a single day, but will be angry with us because of our negligence. Thus we have heard in Ezekiel, likewise Judas, because of one night, lost all his previous labor. So here the idea is you have to keep it up, one slip and you've had it. He concludes this section, I'm skipping a little bit, but he concludes it by saying, for a greater fear and anxiety concerning the torment of hell always dispels the enticement of pleasure and arouses the languid soul. So that's what drives them. It's that fear of hell. If you just keep that in mind, you will not sin. Do not be fearful when you hear of... I'm skipping some more. Do not be fearful when you hear of perfection, nor be surprised at the word, for it is not far from us, nor does it exist outside of us. Perfection is within our reach, and the practice of it is a very easy matter, if only we will. And skipping a little bit more. We need only to will perfection, since it is within our power and is developed by us. For when the soul keeps the understanding in its natural state, perfection is confirmed. The soul in its natural state, when it remains as it was created, and it was created beautifully and exceedingly upright. For this reason, Joshua, the son of Nave, it says here, commanded the people, "Incline your hearts to the Lord, the God of Israel, and John, make straight his paths." Rectitude of soul, then, consists in persevering the intellect in its natural state as it was created, preserving the intellect in its natural state as it was created. On the other hand, when the intellect turns aside and deviates from its natural state, the soul is said to be evil. Thus the matter is not difficult. If we remain as we were made, we are in a state of virtue. But if we think evil thoughts, we are accounted evil. If, then, perfection were a thing to be acquired from without, it would indeed be difficult. But since it is within us, let us guard against evil thoughts, and let us constantly keep our soul for the Lord, as a trust received from Him, so that He may recognize His work as being the same as when He made it. Well, that's basically what I wanted to read. But so the idea is, we are born perfect, and it's just a matter of preserving that natural state. The perfection is within us. It is not to be acquired from without. All we have to do is reach deep in, down inside of us and get that perfection that's there. I'm not sure how you divide it up. But the earliest monks, it's clear that, and in the earliest theology, they considered the body bad, and that the desires are that which causes us to do evil. As time goes on, I'm not sure that he would say that the body is bad. However, a lot of the ideas that came about from that first belief are carried over. That same hatred of anything physical. For instance, the hatred of sexuality, I think, stems from that idea that the created order is bad. The created world is bad. It's evil thoughts. All I know that he says is that evil thoughts, we received evil thoughts and we acted on them. His concept is, whenever an evil thought comes to you, if you are able to dispel it, you have acted righteously. So the fact that an evil thought comes to one's mind is not necessarily condemning. Oh, in his biography, evil thoughts are planted there by demonic forces. Well, that would be perfectly acceptable. That would be in keeping with what he does. In his biography, he usually makes the sign of the cross. And the sign of the cross does wonders. Let me see here. Even so, we need not fear their phantoms. He's talking about forms of demonic spirits. For they are nothingness and quickly disappear, especially if one fortifies himself with faith and the sign of the cross. And in the account, oftentimes when he's in a tough situation, he makes a sign of the cross. Well, that's he uses it only in dire emergency. Well, I don't know, only. But yeah. One time he was attacked by beasts, wild beasts, lions and everything came into his, he was living in some ruins. And just before they were about to pounce on him, he made the sign of the cross and they all disappeared. Okay, so that's monasticism in the East. That's the way it developed. It became very widespread and then continued in these, roughly in these forms, well, even down to the present. Very loosely organized, if organized at all. West, it became popular via Jerome. He's the one who disseminated the life of St. Anthony in Rome and pushed for monasticism in the West. He himself set up like I talked about last week, set up the monastery in Bethlehem, and it was more organized than the Eastern type monasteries had been. Later comes Benedict, who established the Benedictine rule, and he sets up a community of monks where they're divided up in groups of 12, I believe it is, and each group of 12 elects one person to be in charge of that whole group. And they are responsible for their share of the upkeep of the monastery. I don't remember if Benedict was the one who made this rule, but it came along soon after Benedict if he didn't make it. Everyone had to work. Up until the time of Benedict, many of the monks didn't work. They would just do the minimum of labor to keep themselves alive. But by the time of Benedict, they began to see that it was detrimental for the monks to have too much idle time on their hands. So work was required.
Oh.
Well, not necessarily. Let me back up just a little bit. In the writings of the Desert Fathers, the one thing that seems to afflict every monk is boredom. They struggle with boredom, and it's a terrible struggle. And it drives some of them crazy, drives some of them mad. So I think it's largely on the basis of experience. By the time we get to Benedict, which is in the 5th century, it's after Jerome, basically they're concluding that it is harmful for monks to have too much time on their hands. The other thing that's real common in the writings of the Church Fathers is kind of interesting is sexual fantasies, struggling with sexual fantasies. Another thing that was required in the Benedict's code of order, rule of order, another thing that was required were certain ascetic practices were required of everyone. They had to pray a certain number of times a day. They had to read a certain amount of scripture a day. I don't know what all the other things were, but there were a series of things that they were required to do. So kind of standardized their behavior. Well, there are some monks that choose to study, but that was not required in the Benedictine code. For instance, Jerome chose to spend his time studying. So there were some that chose to spend their time studying, but it's a minority of this. But we begin to have a few more. As time goes on, there are more and more that devote their time to study.
Did many of them take those vows of silence that you always sort of hear commonly referred to? You see commonly?
Yeah. We have a branch of, I think that they're a branch of the Benedictine monks called the Trappist monks that come along. But that's in the Middle Ages. As I recall, that's in the Middle Ages. And they would take a vow of silence. Trappist. Well, see, to start out with, as I talked about two times ago, asceticism was a way, the problem was lots of people were becoming Christians and the persecution had stopped. So the way of demonstrating, the ultimate demonstration of faith was removed. Martyrdom was no longer possible. And the church was becoming polluted with people who didn't really believe. So one way of singling yourself apart and saying, I am martyr material, there's just nobody here to kill me, and I am not like the rabble there in the church, they're just showing up so that everybody thinks well of them. One way of doing that was to become a monk. So in the early years, most of the monks refused to become members of the clergy. There were some that would rather die than become priests. As time goes on, more and more of them become priests. And then in the Middle Ages, it is declared that everyone who is a monk is also a priest. Yes, they did. The aversion to being being tied that closely to the church had disappeared by the Middle Ages. And the church had taken other steps which made it essential for them to be priests. The church had decided that only rites which were performed by a priest were valid. So they had to have priests to give them, for instance, extreme unction and all that sort of thing. So they needed to have priests in their monasteries, and some of the monasteries were out in the middle of nowhere, so somebody had to become a priest, and so it was acceptable to them, to for all of them to be embraced. The Benedictine monks developed the habit of going out into places where nobody lived, places that were uninhabitable. Set up a monastery, everyone would start working, because that was required. The problem was, when they did that, the monastery would increase its wealth. The monastery would increase in wealth. Usually the monasteries became wealthy. Once they opened up an area, people would move in around, and pretty soon that uninhabitable region became a metropolis, thriving community, with the economic center being the monastery. And the monastery would grow in wealth. Then a pattern that we'll see over and over, the monastery becomes so wealthy that it becomes a battleground, people politically vying to become the head of the monastery. And it becomes more and more corrupt. And then we have a few monks splitting off and forming another order. So we have a proliferation of orders by the time, by the Middle Ages. The earliest one was the Benedictines, and later we have the Augustinians break off from the Benedictines. And then we have the Cistercians and the Carthusians, I think it's called, and the Carmelites, and the Franciscans, and the Dominicans, and the Jesuits. So we have a proliferation of monastic orders that occurs in the Middle Ages. So in the Middle Ages, that are, yes, that often happened. In the Middle Ages, a lot of the monasteries became extremely corrupt. And that's when we have the proliferation of new orders. People coming along and saying, monasticism is a good thing. All of the monasteries are corrupt. We need to do it a different way.
So yeah,
they start their own monastic order.
So you have tensions between orders?
Definitely. Oh, yes. Vicious. It gets vicious at times. No. In fact, it was deadly at times. There were out and out physical conflicts and assassinations and that
sort of thing. Isn't it like a warrior order?
Well, the Jesuits. Yeah. Okay. Oh. Well, let's look at the basis, the basic concepts of monasticism. There are three of them. These are the principles around which monasticism developed. These are the things that had to be maintained. They were essential. The first was chastity, because chastity was held to be the highest virtue possible. The second is poverty. You had to be poor. You had to give up all of your worldly possessions, or virtually all of your worldly possessions. And the third is humility, is what it's called, but what it really means is obedience to authority. But the understanding was that you had to be individually without worldly possessions. But the monasteries became wealthy, and that's the way. But it reached the point where monasteries were like kind of the gentlemen's club downtown. Some of them were very plush, and so to be the second son to be sent to a monastery wasn't all that bad. I mean, you were kind of taken out of certain spheres. You didn't have some of the social mobility, but it wasn't a dire existence. But it was the monastery that had the wealth. It was not an individual, theoretically. God was blessing the efforts of the monks and making the monastery wealthy. Well, they're doing it now. It's the same thing. They were required to work. They were required to work for half the day. And they don't get paid anything. They get room and board. So whatever their labor produces, that's sold, and they get wealthy. Or before they would, if they go out in the middle of nowhere, someone would have to make furniture. He spends half the day making furniture. Pretty soon your monastery is full of furniture. there's nobody to buy it. Somebody else is supposed to make jewelry. So yeah, everybody's got jewelry.
Or paint the
walls. Or, yeah, whatever. Paint paintings. Do sculptures. Then produce food. Well, they produce more food than they can eat. So then they sell it to people. And it just develops. It's, you've got those laborers working for room and board, and as stuff's sold, and the monastery grows in wealth. In the Middle Ages, all of the developments in agriculture were brought about by monks. They didn't have anything else to do except work in the fields, and they developed methods of agriculture, figured out the genetics involved, developed new breeds, that sort of thing. Humility meant obedience, just like comment on humility, that meant obedience to superior, and by that they meant blind obedience to the superior. There are instances where to test a monk's, a new recruit's faith and willingness to be obedient, they would have the new recruit do something, perform some feat to demonstrate his faith. For instance, throw your son in the river and kill him. And there were instances where they did that. So that's the kind of thing that was required of them, was complete obedience, unquestioning obedience. And that was part of their oath that they swore when they became monks. Well, in this instance, it was someone who became a monk. He became a Christian, and his wife died, and he became a monk, and he had a son. But in the Middle Ages, most of the monks had children. A large percentage of the monks had children. It was out of wedlock that they had children. And when that happened, it's interesting, when that began to happen, then the competition for who controlled the monastery became more fierce, because they wanted to gain control of the monastery so they could divide it up amongst their heirs. The book in the Pelican series on the Middle Ages by Southern, I think his name is, he goes into a lot of detail on, he talks about the priesthood, but he also talks about the monastic system. And he talks about those kinds of wheelings and dealings. But a number of the monks had, well, basically concubines during the Middle Ages. Quite a few of them. And people became monks because in some respects you could do better in the monastic system than if you were outside. The way of the possibilities for gaining wealth and advancing in political power were greater within the monastic system. Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes it was basically a wife. Sometimes it wasn't. And sometimes they had more than one. Well, in the Middle Ages, for a period of time, the monasteries were known for their immorality. That's why you have the new orders developing. You have immorality of every sort. And that's why the new orders develop, because there are people within the monastic system that see it and they say, this is ridiculous. Monasticism is good, but what we've got is trash. We need to start a new order that has rules that will not allow this to happen. So, a lot of similarities. Except for the self-denial part. They don't even give lip service to self-denial. Or humility, that's true. Well, I'll stop there. We could talk about this more. I think it is an interesting topic. Augustine once said that you can find the best of people and the worst of people in the monasteries. And in some ways, the best of Christianity and the worst of Christianity have been in the monasteries. It's a very bizarre phenomenon. It's hard to see how monasticism came, for instance. It would be interesting to see how Paul would have responded to monasticism if you could take him to a monastery and show it to him and say, what do you think of this? It seems so foreign to what Paul was talking about. And yet, as the theology developed in the early Christian church, it's natural. I mean, what else should you do? It seems like the right thing to do. as their understanding evolved. But even though I would say that the whole basis for monasticism is extremely foreign to Christianity, still some of the best things in Christianity came out of the monasteries. For instance, Luther. Augustine was a monk. A lot of theological thinking and scholarship was done in the monasteries. They were the centers of learning and theology in the Middle Ages. If it were not for the monastic system, we wouldn't have our ties to the classical world that do exist. They preserved the writings of the classical world and the theology of the early fathers, especially Augustine. And they copied all those manuscripts.
Except for the ones that...
It's really true. Except for the ones they didn't copy.
The ones that
during the period...
Until the Middle Ages, there are not many of significance. Paula, who went with Jerome to Bethlehem, is considered to be of significance. Helen, the mother of Constantine, is of significance, but I think she became a nun real late in her life. In the Middle Ages, there becomes a number of nuns of note, but I'm not aware of very many until then, until the Middle Ages. There are a handful.
Were there any of them that made a significant contribution to theology or...
Women?
Yeah.
Not that I'm aware of, no.